Welcome to Newton and Co, a podcast for Eye for the Light. I'm here, as usual, with my co-host David Newton. David, how are you today?
I'm very good, thanks, Chris. Good to be back recording another podcast. How are you? What have you been up to?
Me? Oh, I've been keeping very busy. The photography show's just happened, so been up there in Birmingham with another exhibition. And during that exhibition, we met today's guest. David, introduce Jack.
Well, you've done it for me, haven't you? We certainly did meet today's guest. He was a speaker at the Canon Spotlight stage. And he was also doing some workshops for Canon. And I'm going to maybe get this wrong. Photo Speed. Don't shoot me if I've got the wrong one. Thank you. He was talking at Photo Speed as well. So yes, today we have the absolute pleasure of welcoming someone that I've introduced on stage several times now. He is a up and coming or already successful, new but very established workshop running social media sensation with one particular image we'll definitely talk about, landscape photographer from the UK, Mr. Jack Lodge. Jack, welcome.
Gosh, Dave, I think that's the best intro out of all the others. I mean, they were all really good, but that one, like, I'm hyped. I'm like, feel like I'm running out on a boxing ring. Like,
we're gonna get the smoke out.
Yes. How are you and Chris doing? You all good? Thanks so much for having me on. It is great to meet you both at the show, and we're all back now. We're all fresh-ish, aren't we? So really looking forward to getting together and having a good old chat.
Well, Jack, you're a young photographer. How many years have you been doing your photography, and how long have you been professional?
Oh, that's a great question. So I'm 30 years old now. I hit 30 in January, and it's creeping up on me because the old back's playing up a little bit. But I actually started
for thing.
It happens, man. It happens quick, I swear.
You wait, when you get to 40, it becomes your knees.
It's the weight of these bags, I swear. But I mean, I've only been doing it for 10 years. Picked up my first camera when I was at university. I was studying to become an architect, and I picked up a camera to go to Venice and just fell in love with it. So I've been doing it alongside a full-time job for about 6-7 years. And then I quit in August 2022 to go full time. And it was with the support of my now wife. And she said, you know what, if you don't do it now, you'll never do it. And I thought that I didn't have the audience for workshops and tuition and things. I thought it was just prints and putting pictures on socials. But I very quickly realized there's a whole other world out there of people wanting to come out and enjoy the great outdoors with me, because I get very excited on socials. When I do my live videos, I'm jumping up and down and screaming and high-fiving everyone. And I guess it's nice when people can come out with me, because that's my favorite thing to do is to be there with them. So it's just been nuts since. So the last 18 months has just been crazy. But yeah, relatively new to the world of photography, and I kind of wish I started sooner, but I've kind of got straight into the thick of it, should we say.
And you started with landscape. Why landscape? Especially if it was inspired by a trip to Venice. That's not
yeah.
Well-known escape location.
Well, I tell you what, it's funny because I actually started doing street photography and started doing architectural photography, obviously, because my tutor was pushing me to go around all these Carlo Scarpa buildings and these lovely bridges and door handles. So I had like a 40mm pancake lens, and I had no idea what I was doing with settings. So I kind of just watched a few YouTube videos and went out into the field and started taking pictures of people through the back streets, learning about black and white and detailed texture. And then one of my friends said, should we wake up and do a sunrise? It's quite nice down in St. Mark's Square with the gondolas. And I was like, yeah, come on, let's do it. And then I realized the alarm was set for like 4 in the morning. And I was like, oh, blimey, what is this? But we arrived to Blue Hour with these beautiful buildings, lovely water. And I very quickly discovered long exposures. And just my love for the outdoors grew massively. I mean, I was always a massive walker with my dad over weekends and things over the Jurassic Coast. So being able to like document something in Venice, I was like, ooh, this is quite cool. And I very quickly got the bug. And I think I just fell into the landscapes, because when I got home, I've got so much beautiful landscapes around me, whether it's woodlands or coastal walks, that's kind of the route I took.
When you said you've only been professional, what, for 18 months now?
Yeah.
Landscape is not the obvious one that you become professional in, because a lot of people try, many people fail. What gave you the confidence that you thought, you know, actually, I'm just going to do landscapes and that's going to be it? And sod it, I'm putting my colours to that mask.
Well, to be honest, I think it was because it was such a slow growing thing. For the last 4 years before I quit, I had loads of people asking for workshops and tuition and things. I kept saying no. solely because all of my peers and I have a few people that I look up to as mentors were doing them, like doing these workshops. I was like, oh, I can't step on their toes. Like they're the ones that deserve to be doing it. They've been doing it for so long. They're experts in their craft. And, you know, you get that kind of that self-confidence, imposter syndrome. I get it all the time. And I was kind of quite scared for a while. And then got to a point where I was talking to one of them and I said, oh, I've been asked to do all these workshops and things. What do you think? And he was like, yeah, go for it. I was like, I thought you might say maybe there's a bit of conflict of interest. He was like, nope, we're all in this together. You'll bring different people into the genre and you've got a different audience to me. And so I think it was January 2022, I launched 3 workshops for spring because I love bluebells and garlic and things. And I do so much reccing and scouting. And there was only 3 spaces per workshop because I like a really small group because I want it to feel like a one-to-one for everyone. And I launched them on my website thinking I might sell 1 space. And I was like, oh, this is not going to happen. And then I think it took 2 hours and they all sold out. It was just nuts. It just went crazy. So it was at that point, I was like, maybe there is an audience for this and it's all in teaching and processing. But then I was like, I'll try and spread my arms a little bit and keep going with the prints and the calendars and the brand work and not try and limit myself to one field. Because obviously the year prior, I'd seen what happened with COVID. And it kind of like brought an absolute down on workshops and tours. So I thought I have to kind of octopus this out a little bit and spread my arms. So that's what I've been doing pretty much for 18 months. But I think I'm about 180, 190 workshops now. That's including groups and one-to-one tuition. So it's been busy. It's been really, really busy. But I've not had a moment where I've thought, this isn't for me. Like every single day, I'm like, yeah, this is what I want to be doing. I love business. I love the marketing. I love the graphic design. I love the building the website, making logos, like everything. So the photography for me is just, if I'm in the outdoors, I'm happy. It's my kind of like playground, really.
Yeah, you've touched on the photographers that you kind of have respect for and have admired over the years. Who are your inspirations?
There's so many. I could be here forever. But one close friend of mine is a guy called Andy Farrow. He lives down in Swanage. And he kind of took me under his wing a little bit when I first started because I wanted to get into the world of printing. I absolutely love printing. So he invited me to his studio. We got chatting and we started going out together. And he runs workshops all over the country and also abroad. And so I looked up to him massively and we've since become super close friends. Like he was a groomsman at my wedding. And actually, I think 4 people at my wedding were groomsmen who were photographers. So I've got this really close group of friends now where we all love the same thing. And then we've got the likes of Mark Bauer, Ross Hodnot, Anthony Spencer. Dorset is, we're very lucky to have such a great group of photographers. And I look up to all of those. The obvious one for me is Joe Cornish as well. So I know David Cena. I got a print at the photography show from Joe just from his last gallery exhibition. And I just was in absolute awe to spend an hour or so just chatting to him finally, even though we've known each other through PhotoSpeed for years. But we've never actually met, and it was quite a surreal experience. So I have so many people I look up to, and it's very weird to be at something like the photography show talking, especially on like the Canon stand, the PhotoSpeed stand, because I feel like I shouldn't be there. It's a weird feeling. It is a very kind of crazy thought. It's kind of an out-of-body experience the whole time to be amongst those guys, but I still don't think I am that level. I just want to share my passion with as many people as I can, really.
Do you ever look back at the greats of landscape photography? And I'm thinking primarily in the days pre-color photography, the masters of black and white. Do they have any influence on your work?
Yeah, big time. I mean, I really, because I learned or got into photography really late on, I've just been collecting books and books and books. And there's so many, but I kind of, the ones that I kind of skirt around are the Joe Cornishes, the Charlie Waits, the Colin Pryors, like, I would just engross myself in those books. And then I obviously discovered the likes of Ansel Adams and the black and white work. And then I got his book where I discovered how much stuff he does in processing, I guess, in the dark room. And I just found that so inspiring. But even though I'm a big lover of color, I really do appreciate black and white massively. And I think it really helps with the eye. But that's a challenge for me. I want to kind of venture into a little bit of black and white and try and vary my portfolio a little bit. But because I got into the photography very late, I feel like I've got loads of catching up to do to kind of expand my knowledge and experience, really.
It's interesting you talk about expanding your portfolio. Obviously, you've done a lot of work in Dorset.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's your home patch. Do you feel, in terms of expanding your portfolio, that you're getting to a point now where you've kind of cover Dorset. And obviously the light changes, every day is different, the conditions change, but you've visited most of the key spots across Dorset, and maybe you're starting to just repeat the same locations in different light, and it's time to maybe spread your wings a little further.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those where, like, my main thing is capturing the seasons, as you guys saw at the weekend. And I absolutely love revisiting the same locations. But primarily, I've done that over the last 4 or 5 years because I was working a 10-hour a day job, and I was squeezing in these sunrises beforehand, going to work, coming home, processing social media. And that was kind of 3 or 4 times a week. So it was kind of like juggling 2 or 3 jobs, which is great fun. Love it. Loved it to bits for that time. But now I'm full time. I've really tried to venture out. So I've been to Glencoe 4 times, Snowdonia 3 times, and then I've been to Venice 3 times in the last 2 years. And I'm trying to get out as far as I can. But I think because I'm known for Dorset, a lot of my groups and workshops are based down here. But my challenge for the next 12 months is to really expand that and head around Europe, and if I can, further over the next few years.
You mentioned Venice. When you go back now with the experience that you've gained part-time over the 10 years and now as a professional, do you shoot it differently?
Oh, do you know what? I had this conversation with someone the other day, and I think I shoot it differently in terms of technical things, but I've still got the same eye as when I first went. I think now that I've got the kind of knowledge of photography and I know how to use my camera, that my creativity can now flow a little bit. I'm not thinking about settings and things. I'm just more so interested in going at the right time, getting the right conditions. But I actually went back to the same spot I did when I first went to Venice in February this year. And it was quite nice to see it with a new perspective after 10 years of photography. And I ended up taking a very similar shot to the first one I took. But this time I did a little panorama. I used a tilt shift lens and did a pano of all the gondolas in a line. And I experimented with shutter speeds because I wanted them to move a little bit. I didn't want them to move too much. So I guess I looked back at the scene and found my favorite shutter speed, the favorite time of day, and I really thought about composition spacing. Whereas when I first arrived, that first time 10 years ago, I was more looking at shapes, and I was looking at the building, and I was looking at the horizon, and I was putting it on the top third, and all the things I was learning off YouTube and when I Googled, how do you do landscape photography? I was just doing that. Whereas when I went recently, I was just doing me. I just went there, fresh mind. What am I going to shoot this morning? This looks nice. Let's work on this. So it was quite refreshing and quite surreal to go back after all these years.
In terms of your approach, you've talked about some of your inspirations, Joe Cornish particularly, and we know that he's moved on a little bit now, but it was always a 5-4. So he would go out for one picture.
Yeah.
He'd just wait and wait and get one frame. But then more recently, it would seem that a lot of landscape photographers go out and they're just trying to capture as much as they can. And it's not just that one killer shot. They want 5 great shots from the morning. Yeah. And I'm wondering how your approach fits into that. I feel you might be a bit more of the Joe school of thought.
Yeah, you got it, man. Yeah, yeah. That bit freaks me out a little bit because I'm very slow in my approach. Like, I'm the type that has a big tripod and a geared head, and I'll get there maybe 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours before I need to, when the light's in the right place, because I want to really think about composition. And I want to come away one shot from an outing, if I'm lucky. If I don't, I never get down about it because I've learned something. I've learned to go back in 3 months or to go back in different conditions, or just that composition doesn't necessarily work and I'll try again. And I always learn something. But yeah, I think that comes from social media, in all honesty, I think. I really think that the getting 3, 4, 5, 6 shots from one morning is more to do with volume and being like, oh, let's shove out loads of photos. Whereas I'm like, do you know what? If I get one a week, one a month that I'm really happy with, then I'm happy. And then it comes down to whether I just keep putting photos out that maybe aren't portfolio shots, but I know on social media they're going to keep people up to date with my travel and they know I'm out and about. They're not necessarily the ones that go on my website, which I see as my kind of my baby. That's where all my favorite work goes, whereas I treat my socials a little bit differently. But great question. I mean, you see it all the time, don't you?
100%. I guess leading on from that as well, you've become pro. You're talking about getting out on location 3, 4 hours before sunrise. Sometimes stay all day. You might stay into the evening. You're 30. You've got a wife. You've got a young child. How do you juggle that? How does that work?
Man, that's a great question. Because I quit about 2 months before we found out my little boy was coming. And Rihanna and I had this conversation like, God, blimey, I'm glad that worked that way around, because I don't think I would have quit to do this if I found out, because, you know, the whole security thing and things like that. But with the juggling, do you know what? I think because, I mean, Rihanna and I, we've been together since we were 15. So we've been together as long as, it's really cheesy, but we've been together as long than we have apart, kind of thing. So we've got to that point now where we've kind of grown up together. We know each other so well that over the last 7 years, where she knows photography has been my thing, she's like the most supportive person in the world. So like, she's pushing me and just, she's happy if I'm in here in the office and I'm here for 12 hours doing what I love. And then I try and juggle it as much as I can. And the last 9 months with Ethan has been brilliant because I've been at home as well. So when he was born, I could actually take 2 months off. I managed to overwork myself probably in the first half of that year to give myself a little buffer. And then I was like, you know, do you know what? I'm going to take 2 months off and actually spend the time as a family, which was really nice because paternity over here is not good. It's like 2 weeks. And I felt really lucky to have that. And then ever since, it's just been juggling. So we've been away for the last, what, 5 days with Canon. And that was really nice up in Birmingham, but it was quite tough being away. Like, he's learned how to clap between me being away and me coming back. So like, yeah, yesterday he learned to clap. So okay, when I arrived, I was like, oh wow, you can clap now. And it's like, that's only 5 days. So like, it does mean I miss a few things, but like, I don't miss a few things because I know I'm here and I'm here for him as well. So it's just juggling it as much as I can, really.
I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball now, Jack.
Love it. No, I love a curveball.
I'm going to make a statement and then I'm going to ask you about your photography. So nice. British landscape photography is boring. How do you differentiate your work from that of the other landscape photographers, especially UK-based? Because if you look internationally, it's much more varied.
Oh, that's a great question. Do you know why? Because I look up to a lot of American photographers and people go to the Dolomites and they're going to Switzerland and the landscapes are just next level. And then I must admit, I look at home and I'm like, oh, do you know what? That's a challenge. But then I find it more engaging because I want to go out and then capture something different. So like during my talks at the weekend, I was showing images of these locations that I might have been to 25 times, but there's something different about it. Like it's stormlight or it's a rainbow going into a certain point, or I'm trying to capture these scenes that can be seen as quite, but they can be seen as quite iconic or quite common, I guess is the right word to call them, because Dorset's very popular. But then I'm putting myself out there in different conditions and things and trying to capture something different. But I think as the years go on and things, my lust for traveling has just grown massively. And it's one thing Rihanna and I both regret is we went to university, we graduated, full-time job, got a house, got a dog, as you do. Love Pip and my dog. And now we've had a baby and it's like, whoa, like we're 30 now. We can't just pack up and go away for 3 or 6 months. Like it's different. It's very, very different.
I think you're telling the wrong people that.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's different, isn't it? And then, like, I was speaking to my cousin the other day, and she's only 22. She's like, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm just going to graduate. And I was like, please go traveling 6 months to a year if you can. Just go explore and, like, then think about a job. Because, like, I think there's so much to see now, especially as I'm seeing it as a landscape photographer. I'm just like, yeah, I missed out on that part. But I'm hopefully going to be making up for it now over the years. Fingers crossed.
You talked about juggling. You said you know, you might go and sit in your studio for 12 hours a day, and you know, Rihanna will support you doing that. She'll take Ethan and let you sit in there. What are you doing for 12 hours a day sitting in your studio if you're a photographer who wants to be outside?
Yeah,
comes round to the question of your photographic approach. Are you like filters or post production?
Yeah. Oh, great.
What do you spend that time doing?
Yeah, do you know what though? Those days they come few and far between. To be fair, they're mainly admin days. They're planning itineraries for all my workshops because I always plan them a week before. I have a date in the diary for that workshop, and I always say to my clients, "Look, I'll send you an itinerary a week before because it's all based on weather. So I'll look at those weather charts, study where best to go, and I've only had to rearrange one over the last 18 months. That's how efficient we've been with weather conditions." And then the rest of the time is printing. So behind me, so catching up on print orders over those 12-hour days. But that probably only happens once every 2 weeks. The other times I'm out in the field. So, but going back to your question about filters as well, I love processing. So I am one of those that loves processing. And it's only because I've used Photoshop and Lightroom since I was 15, when I was doing graphic design at school. And I've just grown up loving it. And I started using graduated filters. That was kind of my into landscape photography was I went down to Kimmeridge Bay down here in Dorset, and I was framing up this lovely ledge going out to the sea. And some guy came along. I still to this day have no idea who it was. It might have been just a really famous landscape photographer. I have no idea. And he said, "Oh, what are you doing?" I was, "Oh, I'm just practicing landscape photography." And this must have been 2015. And he said, "Oh, have you ever used a big stopper?" And I was like, "A what? Like, what's that?" And he was like, "Put this bit of glass on the front and let me show you how to take a picture for 2 minutes." And I was like, "Okay." And he did. And my picture came back ethereal and like just feeling and emotion and very blue, I have to say. And I later discovered why it was very blue. But it was just so different to what I was seeing with my eyes. And then he went off and explored. He was like, "Right, I'll be back in 2 hours. You play with my filter set and you just explore." So I was like picking these filters out, and it was graduated filters. And I was like trying to make them work and things. And I really learned then that cameras capture a completely different image to what our eyes see. So I was looking at exposures of skies and exposures of foregrounds, working how to blend them with grads. And then just over the years, I've just used grads less and less and started bracketing and then blending with luminosity masks. One, because I find it quite fun and quite engaging. And two, because it speeds up the process a little bit, which is very contradictory because I love being outdoors. So like I say that, but I'm the type of person that if I go out for a walk and take a picture for 8 hours and I come back and it's not a picture and I've just bin it, I'm happy. So like it's a really weird, I'm in that in-between kind of category of people, I guess, because some people love using loads of filters, some people don't. And I'm like in between, but I personally don't at the minute. I just use magnetics that snap on, and I'll use my NDs and polarizers, but I don't use grads. But deep down, maybe I should be, because I'd like spending more time in the field getting one picture instead of doing Photoshop work at home. But yeah, maybe it's something I need to discover in myself over the next few years and kind of balance it out.
It'll be interesting to see how your approach changes or evolves, especially at the moment where we've got the growth of AI and I, in many cases, because I see a lot of pictures, I see a lot of pictures that are over-processed or processed for the sake of processing when they don't really need it.
Yeah.
Do you think you might review the way you're going with your processing and revert back to working with light rather than on the computer? Or do you think you're on a different course to that?
It could be. I think it mainly comes down to, are we talking about graduated filters here and getting it?
Yeah, you're controlling light.
Controlling light with the filtration
and with the camera, as opposed to then applying some of those controls afterwards in the computer darkroom.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. I mean, I've had to do it quite a lot in workshops. What you said is something I'm a big believer in, is I do see over-processing a lot. I used to do it myself as well, still probably do to some extent. But when it comes to a lot of photos, the worst thing for me is when I see a really dark sky and really bright sea. And I'm like, oh, like you've not understood how light works. Like the sky is always going to be brighter than reflections. Or I see these shots with the sun and they try and bring the highlights down. And it goes gray. And I'm like, no, like you look into the sun, you can't see any detail. Like, why are you trying to bring it back? Like there's nothing there to see. So I've had on many occasions, I've had workshops where we use circular filters for ease. But then that client say is like, oh, I'm going to get home and I'm going to share that photo. I don't do much processing. So I'm just going to upload it to the computer, do a bit of contrast and share it. I'm like, oh, are you going to use a virtual grad to bring that down in Lightroom? Because with masking now, we can just put it in afterwards. And they're like, no, I don't do any of that. And I'm like, oh, okay, in that case, right, take the filters off. Here's a graduated filter kit. Now I'm going to teach you how to use graduated filters and why they're so important, because otherwise they forget about that part of the process. So we'll go through using a 0.3 stop, a 6 stop, a 9 stop, or a 1 stop, 2 stop, 3 stop, and we'll go through the different graduated filters, and I'll say, right, this is the one you use for this occasion. And if the sky gets brighter, use this one. And if the horizon's more jaggedy, use this one. Or if it's a straight horizon, use this. And their mind just blows. They're like, oh wow, that's how you get a shot in one camera. That's how you do it. Whereas beforehand, they just share it and there'd be a really bright sky, really dark foreground. And it's not what you see in real life, is it? It's really hard for a camera to capture all that dynamic range. But yeah, that's how I approach it. And maybe I'll change over the years, but with luminosity masks and the camera with the stop control now with these 15 stops of dynamic range, it is very easy to get back into Lightroom and recover those highlights or recover those shadows with a bracketed exposure if I need to. But that's just my workflow at the moment. Who knows what I'll do in 6 months or 9 months as I love my love for the outdoors grows, shall we say.
my introduction said that you'd had quite the rapid rise, but actually you didn't have quite the rapid rise from what you're saying. You know, it was 10 years of...
A lot of people think that, though. When I went full-time, honestly, the amount of comments I had on Instagram going, I thought you'd been full-time for years. I'm like, no, I had a full-time job. Like, and then the people were like, oh, it's not that easy then, is it? I'm like, no.
Was there a tipping point or something like, I mean, I'm kind of awkwardly referring my way around to that image of Durdle Door that was massive, what, 6 months ago, 8 months
Gosh,
ago?
Yeah, December. So, yeah, four months
December,
ago.
December, yeah. So not 4 months ago. God, it feels like it's been around forever because I've seen it everywhere. Was there something that like really sparked that rise to fame, shall we say, or rise of public consciousness, or just it was continual hammering growth day on day, week on week, month on month?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I mean, it's kind of grown a lot over the years. I'm one of those photographers, it's really weird to say that I owe pretty much where I am to social media, which is a horrible thing to say because like I have such a love-hate relationship with social media, but I've only able to run workshops and things because of me documenting my journey. And what I do love, though, is that on Facebook particularly, I have such a loyal audience. I know all these people on first name basis now, and they're always going to comment and engage. And I just have this really nice relationship with everyone that over the last few years has just skyrocketed. I mean, I think when I went full time, I think I had like 15 or 16,000 followers on Instagram. And I think over the last 18 months, it's gone to nearly like 40, I think. So like numbers have just gone crazy. But I think that's primarily from that Durdle image that just went absolutely ballistic that I did not expect at all. And then also a few reels. I've done a few reels that I'm just experimenting with. You get one good one of those. And I think I had like 10,000 followers from one reel that was just so random. Like I was doing it in bed just with some cheesy music. And the next day it just went, had like a million plays. And I was like, whoa, like what's happened here? So whether that's pure luck or just me being really persistent, like I might post 7 times a week or 5 times a week. I don't know. But yeah, it has been steady, like you said. But I think probably the last 3 years since I did we took a 3 month sabbatical in the start of 2022. We lost Rihanna's mum, but slightly before then, which was really tough. So we had a kind of like a reality check moment where we both said to our work, we need 3 months off. Like we've been caring for her for 2 years and it got really, really bad. And she sadly passed away. And we're like, no, we need 3 months off to recoup. We went to Norway it ended up being 4 weeks in the end. And I then got a bug for being out with the camera, like properly. And it was during that moment, I was like, I need to quit and find a way into photography full time. And that's when I really pushed the socials. And I was like really pushing on Facebook and Instagram and bringing people out with me on live videos and things. And the audience just kept growing from there. And yeah, social media is a funny one, but I love it and I hate it at the same time. What I hate is there's no control. I have no control over it. Instagram could change their algorithm and all of a sudden all my audience where I sell to is gone. So my main focus at the minute is website, newsletter, and getting that direct to business, I guess, relationship growing, just in case one day social media decides to disappear, which does scare me a little bit.
You and David have both referred to an image of Durdle Door. For those listeners who are not familiar with it, can you tell us what the image was and what happened?
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. Sorry. So in December, first week of December 2022, I took a trip on my own down to Durdle Door to capture a shot I've been after for 5 years. Well, I say after, I've been trying every year for the last 5 years. And there's a 2 to 3 week window here in Dorset where the sun actually rises through the arch. So Durdle Door, if anyone's seen it, it's a rock formation going out to the sea. And it's often referred to as the drinking dragon, the way it shapes out into the sea. And if you time it right on the beach and you line up your sun with TPE or photo pills, you can see it rises directly through the arch. And I went down there with the intention of getting the sun rising right through the arch on a clear day. But it happened to be a really stormy day, but there was a tiny gap on the horizon. So the sun came up for 5-10 minutes, created the most beautiful sun star through the arch and created this glow of light touching the sand. But about 2 minutes after that, the waves were crashing against the door. And because of the temperature change, because it's quite cold, there was like mist forming off the water. I actually then changed my approach to photograph it from a slight angle and get the light rays coming through the door with no sun star, which can be seen as quite cheesy. So I tried a different approach and got that. So I ended up getting two shots of the same morning, which is very rare for me. I normally focus on one. And then I posted that, and it was funny because I knew as soon as I took it, it was quite special because it was something I've not seen before with the light coming through. And it was one of those where I just had goosebumps the whole walk back up to the car, and because I parked actually miles away and I did the long walk back. And what I did is I actually took my memory card out of my camera and put it in my pocket because I shoot raw on both cards. But I was really worried that if anything happened to my camera, I'm going to lose the shot. So to be safe, I put one in my pocket and I kept one in the camera. And then I posted it and it just went nuts. It got picked up by BBC local to me, so BBC South. And then actual BBC decided to share it and they put it on their homepage. And then BBC Earth got involved and it just went crazy to the point where I think it was like 2 a.m. and I had an email from someone in Canada. And they're like, oh, can we do a quick Zoom interview? And we'll put you on the TV the next day. So I woke up because I was looking through my phone and it kept flashing. So I woke up, I got downstairs in my pajamas, did a Zoom call. And then he was like, oh, actually, do you know what? I've loved our conversation so much. The news presenter's live in 5 minutes. Do you want to go on the live TV? I was like, can I at least put a jumper and a hat on or something? Because I was an absolute mess. And then ended up being on live TV in Canada, which was just unreal. And a few of my fellow photographers, like Adam Gibbs in Canada, was like, I've just seen you on TV. Like, what's going on? And I was like, I have no idea. The social media changes kept going crazy. But for me, it is a really special shot. And I absolutely love it. But I did not expect the reaction it got at all.
Some people think, oh, you know, you're really lucky to have got those conditions. And yet you've been back to that location for 5 years with an idea in mind to try and capture a particular shot. So
you
know, this whole idea that luck makes a picture, luck, perseverance.
It may, you just touched planning. It. Yeah, patience and I mean, that's another one of my talks, patience and persistence and perseverance. It's so important. And also planning. So I get really cheesy with one of my talks. There's like the four P's. And I got patience, persistence, planning, photographing, processing, and also printing. So the P's keep going on. But there's all of those things to me, they form landscape photography. And you've got to be a little bit good at each one. Do you know what I mean? There's no point being really good at photography, but you don't enjoy processing or you don't enjoy planning. So for me, I try and spread my arms out on all of those and try and get a bit good at each one. And then sometimes, like the dirtle shot, it comes together. But I mean, if I'll show you, like some of the shots I've taken over those years are horrendous, like of the dirtle door shot. And I've tried, I think it was 8 or 9 times that I got folders for in Lightroom, where like I had completely clear sky days and I got the burst coming through, but it was a tiny little burst because I wasn't using a high enough quality lens with loads of elements. And then I discovered, oh, actually, do you know what? You need these 9-11 element lenses to get those super crisp stars. So over the years, I had to slowly invest and then change my approach and change my settings and go from F16 to 22 and then think, oh, can I blend an F11 to an F22 shot? And all these things I've tried over the years. And in the end, I just did a 1 F22 exposure to get the shot. Because when the sun still happens like that with a tiny little gap, you don't have time to blend different shots. Like I wouldn't be able to do that. So diffraction is a scary thing. But I mean, I think that print was done at like 3 meters big and it's pin sharp. So as long as I do a little bit of extra sharpening, it can save the day. But yeah, patience, persistence, and there's so much going on behind the scenes.
Please tell me you said you've got the P's. Before Chris asks his next question, please tell me you know the military 7 P's.
No.
You've never heard of this?
So prior planning prevents piss poor performance.
That's no. The one.
Proper. I just think it just came to my head.
Piss poor performance.
Cool.
Please tell me you've heard of that.
Yeah, I have now. When you said it, I was like, oh no, yeah, it's twigged. Yeah. It's so true though, isn't it?
It is 100%.
God, I mean, it's like, and people forget that in photography. They just go out to get one shot and they're like, oh, I'm going out today. I'm going to go down into the woods. I'm like, why are you going to the woods? They're like, oh, because I've got a free day and I like the woods. I'm like, yeah, but is the weather good for the woods? Or like, is it the right time of year to go to the woods? Like, there's so many things before that.
Talking to you, it's really interesting. Clearly, you're hugely passionate, but you're also, and I don't say this lightly, you're very knowledgeable about the environment, about the locations, about the weather. There's there's almost like a Rain Man level of attention to detail of that kind of area. of understanding the weather patterns and understanding the conditions and what the light's going to be doing and what the location's going to be doing in different weather conditions and different light. And is that innate? Have you worked on it? Where does it come from? What tools do you use to help you figure out the weather? You know, if you were talking to someone and say, they said, how do I find out what the weather's going to be and how do I know reliably what it's going to do? What? How do you do it?
Oh, amazing. I mean, tomorrow is a prime example of that because I have a client one-to-one and they're like, oh, I want to go photograph this. And I was like, oh, we can't photograph that tomorrow. It's not the right conditions. It's going to be potentially foggy and misty and very cold. So we're going to now head down to the rivers and the valleys and try and get some nice conditions. And that's only because I study the weather so much, man. Like I use an app and a web app, and it's on my phone as well, called Ventusky. I don't know, or Ventusky, or however you pronounce it properly. And it allows me to actually look at the weather charts. And you do almost become a storm chaser. It's got to points on workshops where I have two people in the back, one in the front. I give them an iPad in the front and it's got the recent weather radar on it. And we are chasing conditions. Like I can see a little gap in, and I'm like, right, we're going to head 40 minutes north because it looks like we're going to get some light rays or there's going to be some nice conditions up there. So we change our original plan and go with it. And they love it. They love it because you get adrenaline and it's like you are almost, I mean, I say storm chasing, I'm just endorse it. We don't actually get proper storms. Like I'm not like Mike Oblinsky and guys that are actually properly doing it. But like it is quite fun to chase conditions. And Ventusky is a really good one. Met Office is okay, but I never use the other ones. We've got Clear Outside, which is also okay for showing different levels of cloud. So over the years, I've really studied the difference between low cloud, medium cloud, high cloud. They all dictate where I go. So if there's 100% high cloud, that lovely wispy stuff in the sky, and there's no low cloud or medium cloud, I might go down to the coast. I want water, like, because I know if there's a gap on the horizon, there's going to be a bit of color. We're going to get reflections and beautiful, bright skies and things. If it's the opposite and it's all low cloud, I might be up high somewhere in the hills in a woodland or something where we've got atmosphere and quiet light, as I'd call it, or soft light that we work with. Or I'd be down at the coast doing super long exposures. I think that's probably because you touched on it. You said like I've been in Dorset a lot, and I haven't, to be honest, hardly traveled at all. But I think what it's allowed me to do is become like really knowledgeable of my patch, I guess, which is probably like a 3 hour driving radius, to be fair. But I know within those 2 or 3 hours, I've got a Google Pins that's got 300, 400 pins on it. But I know where to go and what conditions. I'm learning every day with that. So sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it works. And it's just chasing weather, which I love. And I would love to get to a point where I can do that in other places. Like I need to travel more. Like, I'd love to be able to do that in like Scotland and Wales and just further afield, like the Dolomites or like Canada. But it just becomes with experience. And I think I'd love to grow that by going with people that have done it. So like the locals that really know their area, and whether I partner with them and we do something together, or I just go there for a month, just go with them and just see what they do and just learn and shadow and get to know a patch or area really, really well. And if I can, you know me, but go back in each season. That's my thing. I would like, imagine going to Dolomites in each season and finding a composition you love, like a composition that gives you goosebumps. But you go back in spring, autumn, summer, winter, and you get the same shot in different seasons. Like, that gets me well excited. But I hope that answered that question. I think I probably went off on a big old tangent.
You mentioned the learning process you went through with lenses and lens quality.
Yeah.
What about focal length and your lens choice with making a particular image?
Yeah.
How do you go about that? How do you approach that? And how does your style determine which lens you choose?
That is an amazing question, because workshop clients always say to me, Jack, you're making me change the lens again. I've changed the lens more today than I have in 3 years. And it's because each scene, to me, deserves a different lens sometimes. But I have a really boring answer for what my most used lens is. And everyone thinks, oh, it's going to be a 15 to 35, 14 to 35. It's not. It's a 24 to 105 f4. And it's because it's so versatile. I'm using that a lot of the times to see and visualize. But whenever a scene deserves something else, I'm changing my lens all the time, like 3 or 4 times. And I did it recently where I booked a very spontaneous trip to Snowdonia and I shot it from blue hour to about middle of the day. And I just kept changing my lenses every 10, 15 minutes. And I was getting the wide vista. And then when the light hit the peaks and you get that beautiful alpenglow on the snow, my 100 to 500 was on. And I was from one extreme to the other, trying to get that compression. Yeah, I love switching lenses. And I think each one has its own use. So like my 15-35, I know makes some of the best sun stars I've ever seen in my life. So I'll use that if I'm trying to get that effect. Or if I'm down at the coast and I really want the subject to come at me, and on, like, say I'm in the water and I want someone to feel like they're going to get splashed, I will have that lens on super wide and I'll have my tripod super close to the wave. And I'll take that risk of the lens getting soaking wet, as long as it's all insured. But I'll try and get that feeling. Whereas when I'm out and the light's beautiful and it's misty vistas, I'll have my 100 to 500 on. So yeah, I've kind of got to a point where all these areas that I've been to, I've studied with different lenses and I find they work better with certain lenses than others. I try and limit myself to 3 lenses if I can. 15-35, 24-105, 100 to 500. So I'm covered from 15mm to 500. So nothing can stop me. I've got full range. But then I also love my tilt shift lens. So obviously, architectural background, I like straight lines and verticals. So I took that out to Venice, for instance, and used it for panos and nice big scenes where I wanted the building nice and straight all the way up. So between those, I'm covered quite well. But I'm always lending them to clients. Like whenever they've not seen a photo taken at 500mm, they're like, oh, I left that lens at home because it's wildlife photography. And I was like, one, you didn't read the itinerary because I said, bring as many lenses as you can carry. And two, I'm like, well, put mine on or see it on my camera and you'll see why it's important to explore with different lenses.
It's interesting that you mentioned with the architectural stuff, you use a tilt shift lens rather than trying to do that in the computer.
Yeah.
You kind of do revert back to that initial technique. Yeah. How did your love of street photography inform your landscape? Is there any influences that cross over between the two?
Yeah, massively. My mum's actually got one of my first street photos on her wall still. I can tell you exactly what photo that is because it was the first one I took. And it was this mime man in Venice sat down eating a pizza and he just looked straight at me for that moment. And my camera was set to black and white. He had a black and white striky gondola shirt on. And I captured that exact moment. And then he came up to me. I was like, oh, can I have a look? And he had a look and he was like super happy. We exchanged contact details. I sent him a print. And I was just starting to get connections together. And then I looked back at the photo and I had already subconsciously got down on his level and was photographing his eyes at my lens height. And I got my verticals nice and straight, all in camera. And I think it was all subconscious because doing architecture and graphic design and obviously just, yeah, building stuff, subconsciously, I transferred that into photography, I guess. And I was doing that through my DSLR at the time. And now that's kind of pushed its way into landscape photography because I look at landscapes exactly the same. I'm looking for odd numbers. I'm looking for those 3 trees or the 1 tree, or I'm doing the whole border control and I'm looking for equal spacing at certain points and leading lines. And there's so many similarities in architecture with street photography and landscape photography. It's massive. I kind of miss doing street photography. I did bits in Venice when I went with people in February, but it's something that I've kind of not properly tried again since getting into landscapes, which is a bit strange. But I think that's because my passion is landscapes now, but I've kind of kept towards that genre, I guess, with a bit of wildlife thrown in from time to time.
When we started talking, you went straight in with the role of social media and all the busy activities you were doing, which have obviously been a major part in building your career.
Mm-hmm.
Are you able to monetize it going down this route, especially in an area like landscape, which is notoriously difficult to make a living in?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I guess I don't monetize my social media presence, like in terms of posts, other than the odd occasion when I do things with brands, and I'm very strict on that. I have a very not strict policy because I don't have my own policy, but like I only work with brands that I like and use and really believe in. But I hardly do any of that type of stuff. Like I'm just posting my own work. And the other way of monetizing it for me is prints. Like I love printing. So when I post a story of a print literally coming out of my printer and I'm zoomed right in, and then I zoom out and it's actually on paper, people are commenting like, oh gosh, I thought you were there. Like I want that print on my wall. But if I don't post about prints, I don't sell prints. Like I have to show people I'm printing or talking about paper and things. And so I guess I monetize it off of that. And then the other one's workshops is the majority is through workshops and tuition. So I'll always do content on my socials of us as a group out in the elements. And then people off the back of that will be like, I want to be that person that stood on top of Corfe Castle in the mist, or I want to be that person getting splashed by the waves. And I guess that works. So yeah, monetizing it is in different ways. Yeah, I guess you have some social media, I hate the word, but like influencers that do, I guess, sponsored posts and ads, and that's their way of monetizing. But I've not really got into that world of things because my love for the outdoors is my main focus, really. And if I can monetize photography off of that, yeah, even better. If it allows me to do it as a full-time job, I mean, yeah, in my absolute element.
It's social media for marketing rather than social media making money directly.
Thank you. You should have told me that before. That's literally it. Yeah. Yeah. You answered the question in such a better way than me. Yeah. Yeah. That's it. It is. And I think it's because when I was working full time, I took on the role of doing a bit of marketing for my employer at the time. And I learned quite a lot about that. I think I tried to apply that to my photography, and that's where I use social media to my advantage and make the most of that.
You want to travel more, you want to see more places, but where do you see your photography going in the next 5 years? What are your goals? What are you hoping to achieve?
I really, 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 and it's cheesy, but I really want to do a book. I want to have a body of work that isn't on a hard drive. So I want to keep doing what I'm doing with my prints because they do quite well, keep pushing prints out. But I want to push my passion for the seasons eventually one day into a book. And I don't necessarily want that to be limited to Dorset or the UK. I would love to challenge myself to get out there way more. And basically, my goal, I mean, how long have I been doing it? Serious. I'd say 5 or 6 years. So I don't know, by the time I'm 40, how cool would it be to have the same knowledge of my local area now in somewhere else, like Dolomites or anywhere? So let's just say a random place. I would love to have that. And maybe if I'm lucky enough to get to 60 or 70, maybe I've done it in 3 or 4 locations. And I have a body of work where I have the change of seasons in 3 or 4 countries. Like, that would just be awesome. I would love that. And then on that journey, be able to share it with others. Yeah, just be outside as much as I can and maybe try and do what I've done here in other places. That's probably my favorite thing. And if it could be a book or working with a big brand or something, like a documentary, how cool would that be? I don't know. We need something on TV. You have YouTube as such a big thing. I don't really get into the world of that, but I think it'd be so cool to document that. There's so many cool things you could do. Yeah, little old me wouldn't have the capability to do that, but I think there's some cool things that could be done over the years.
I've led with that question, but I guess we're kind of getting to the point of asking the question that Chris always hates. If you know, regular listeners will know, I've led with your longer term plans looking forwards, and it almost feels odd to ask you at 30. My next question, but if you could look back to the younger you, maybe when you were starting out or 5 years ago, or maybe we'll slightly reframe it and say, if you were talking to a young photographer now, you're talking to a teenager who aspires to be the next Jack Lodge.
That's a crazy thing to hear. That's not going to happen.
Oh, you never know. Don't do yourself down. I mean, they might want better hair. That would be.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, come on. They've got to be better looking at least.
what advice would you give the younger you, the person, the next wannabe Jack Lodge or someone that is just desperate to get into landscape photography and can't make it work or whatever? Uh-huh. It could be advice about anything.
Yeah, I think I get it a lot. I get a lot of people asking me, oh, I want to do what you do with workshops and travel and things. How do I do it? And then they tell me they've only been doing it 6 months or 9 months. I'm like, you really do just need to live and breathe photography or live and breathe landscapes. I think landscapes photography is such a hard genre. It's not like you can open a studio and start practicing. And portraiture is obviously so difficult as well. It's such a talent to use flashes and light and understand how it works. But landscape photography is like, no, you are at mercy to Mother Nature, like whatever the weather's doing. And I think my best advice and thing, something that I would just do again, is just do what excites you as much as you can. And they call it, don't they, a flow state. And I love that saying all the time. And it's the same with my photography, but get into something that is a flow state. It's something you're doing so much that you don't think about a single thing. All that anxiety and stress of the outer world, whether it's work or family or friends or whatever, disappears And when you're with that tripod in that woodland, or when you're in that tripod with that mountainscape, you're there for 3 hours and you forget to drink. You forget to look at your phone. Like you're not doing a thing. And if someone does do that, and you're doing landscape photography and you want to do landscape photography because you see other people do it, but you're not in that moment, you're not in that flow state, then potentially that's not for you. Maybe you need to try something else, and that's okay. You might just find a different genre, or you might find a different thing. I thought mine was architecture. I thought I was going to be an architect, design and buildings all around the world. And then I got to a point where one day it wasn't, and I realized what my flow state was. And I think that's the best advice I can give. Don't force yourself to do something you don't want to do. And if you can't monetize that and make it financially possible, find something that can do that with as little of your time as possible, and build and build and build and build on the side. It's such a big thing. And it took me 6 or 7 years to get to that point. That's the best advice I can give. Just focus on you and build something on the side. And if you have to have 18-hour days, you have to have 18-hour days. I never thought about it, you know, when I was working. I had people at work saying, "You're crazy. What were you doing this morning up at 5 o'clock? So I got lost in the woods doing woodland photography. And they're like, "Oh, you've got to come to work for 8 hours now." And I'm like, "Yeah." But like, and they're like, "What are you doing at lunch? Do you want to have lunch with the team?" I was like, "No, I'm going scouting in the New Forest." And they're like, "What do you mean scouting?" I'm like, "No, I'm going to go look at somewhere else to go for tomorrow." I guess I just had that mentality of like just living and breathing it.
I'm going to sum that up your bit about...
Please, can you do a better summary? Because I just waffle. Yes. I need you to quote everything I do, please. Because I just talk nonsense for 5 minutes after you ask me a question. Just say it in like 6 words.
It's okay to not do the thing you thought you wanted to do if you find something better.
Thank you. That's it. There we go. He's done it. That's it. People put too much pressure on themselves, don't they? Like, "Oh, I want to be a landscape photographer. I want to be a wildlife photographer." And you do it for a year and you're like, "I'm not enjoying this. I'm finding it stressful. I want to make money from it." And it's like, yeah, but if you want to make money from it, you shouldn't be thinking about making money from it. Like, you've messed up on rule one there, really. You should just be doing it because you love it.
And that would seem like a really good point to end it on. Jack, thank you for sharing your world with us and your experiences. And what I think most people will find listening to this is quite a different and invigorated approach to making your way in landscape photography.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been brilliant to chat, Jack. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your world with us and giving us an insight into what makes you tick, which is clearly the weather and landscapes and seasons. How could I forget the seasons? And Dorset. Sorry, I forgot Dorset.
Yeah, don't forget Dorset. Yeah. And you need to get that out of me. I need to get out.
Do it.
Thank you for inviting me along. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.